Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Sustainable Food Forum held in London in September 2023. This session was entitled, We Become What We Eat, and So Does the Planet, Changing Global Diets. Our panel discusses the opportunities and challenges presented by a global shift towards healthier and more sustainable diets, but asks, are consumers ready for a new source of food? How willing are they to make dietary changes? And how do we transition to more sustainable diets? Your host is the journalist and broadcaster, Shay Rhodes.
If we can just give me a rough introduction to you, the company that you work for, and how you came to be here. If we start with you, Paloma, roughly 3 minutes, if you can.
Hi, everyone. My name is Paloma Lopez. I am a food entrepreneur. My company is called FutureFit Foods. It's based in Colorado. I have spent close to 20 years working in food. I've worked inside of large companies, and for the last 3 years have been building a business that is trying to design for the change we're hoping to see, putting human and planetary health at the center of design. One of the things that I, one of the big ahas of my career was that there is a need to design for change, and that a lot of the food industry today has designed for, or started designing for, the foods we have today many, many years ago. A little bit designing for the past versus the present, and that we need to address design in how we create not just foods, but food ecosystems as well, and that involves also business models and new business models. So through FutureFit Foods, our intent and our work right now has been to put products into the market to learn from what works and what doesn't work when you're trying to design for change. So our primary vehicle for change is actually through experimentation. Three things that I wanted to mention around particularly behavioral change and creating a desire for foods that are more sustainable and healthier is, one, you know, as entrepreneurs, as people who are involved in the food industry, we've got to really think about design. We can't just think about sustainability programs that kind of patch for the things that were never designed to be what we want into the future. And so it's really important that we focus on product and on food ecosystems and create food ecosystems that are enabling. And secondly, I think, you know, when you're working in a food system that has been highly concentrated in, you know, in a few players, if you're trying to create change outside of that system that favors scale, it's really, really important that we play also at the local and regional level, because our ability to create value and create a narrative where people understand the value you're delivering to them, both from a human and a planetary perspective, is much, you've got much more control and much more probability of success than if you're trying to go and play against the really large players where you need to have very high, significant scale to be successful.
Dr. De Klerk, if you can you introduce yourself a bit?
Just introduce ourselves.
Yeah, right? Just tell me a little bit more, a little bit about yourself and how you came to be, well, here.
Great. Hi, everyone. I'm Fabrice De Klerk. I'm science director at EAT. So I think I'm the scientist on the panel, which means you're supposed to be able to trust me, I hope. EAT is a small NGO which worked at the interface of science, policy, and business. As science director, our main product is really the Atlantic Commission, whose goal was to be able to describe what is a healthy diet, what are the environmental limits to food production, what are the planetary boundaries of food, and then how do we navigate a transition towards healthy and sustainable diets. By way of background, I'm an ecologist, studied in California. I also work with the Consultative Group for National Agriculture, so with smallholder farmers in Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, on regenerative or sustainable production. And I think, you know, the biggest message that I think I want to start out with today is that there's a real value in being able to think systemically and to make the link between production and consumption, and even some really critical system shifts that happen when you're able to make those two links.
Great, thank you very much. And then moving down the line, Edwin Bark, yep. Tell me a bit more about yourself.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Edwin Bark. I'm Senior Vice President at Redefined Meat. At Redefined Meat, we love meat. We truly love meat. We just think it doesn't need to come from animals. We've created the company 5 years ago with the idea to leverage technology and plant-based ingredients to create the first whole-cut meat, which is what we currently do using additive manufacturing as a technology. By the way, that's not only the only technology that we use. We use multiple process technologies. But fact is that we are trying to seduce the carnivores to come into the category and eat more plant-based meat without giving up on the experience of animal meat. I've been busy setting up the business in the EMEA region since 2021, resulting in a factory that supplies the EMEA region from the Netherlands, go-to-market teams in the UK, the Benelux, the DACH region, as we call it, Germany, also Switzerland, France, Italy, and Sweden. So that's where we are. There's three topics related to the food transition that we're talking about today. One is communication when it comes to convincing those carnivores. That's where you can really make the big impact on changing the meat consumption. Communication, it is about innovation, developing products that really meet the standards and the tastes of all those different consumers. And it's about collaboration. The challenge that we're facing as an industry is way too big to try to solve it on your own. So I'm a big believer that collaboration will help us further drive innovation and to meet those expectations of consumers to really drive change.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Jenny, if I can ask you to say a few words about yourself.
My name is Jenny Arthur. I head up membership development of our core food program at WRI, which is part of our sustainable diets program as well.
WRI, very well known in the US, not so much in Europe. We are a global environmental research organization. We work with governments, businesses, and local organizations on climate action. WRI is the founding member of the Science Based Target Initiative and hosts the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. One of the programs within WRI's Sustainable Diets team is Cool Food. We have 70 global members that cross all different sectors. So we work with universities, we work with cities, we work with corporate clients, we work in healthcare, and we help them to set a target to reduce their food-related greenhouse gas emissions. We help them to benchmark and track reductions in their greenhouse gas emissions. And we help them to nudge consumers towards more plant-based diets by using the latest environmental and behavioral science to help scale healthy, sustainable meals. So that's what we do at WRI. In terms of my sort of three areas, I think one of the key points is understanding and getting consumers to understand the climate impact of food. Also looking at how we can work more closely with consumers through the collaboration and how we can work with companies as well, what we can do, how we can help them to assist consumers to switch to a more health sustainable diet.
Excellent. One thing which I haven't checked before sitting down here is we do have one person taking part in Didi Unelli, who is going to be remote. Is she online?
Good morning.
Didi, hi.
Hi, great to be here. I'm calling in from New York.
Thank you
for the Anga Week and climate. So I'm not with you in person, but would have loved to meet with you all. I wear a number of hats in the food ecosystem as the founder of African Food Changemakers, which is a community of entrepreneurs working across Africa. And our commitment is to help enable them to scale their businesses, to nourish Africa and change global narratives. Work with entrepreneurs in 38 African countries, providing training, access to funding, data, and it's a really amazing community that has been thriving over the last few years. I'm also the co-founder of Sahel Consulting, which is focused on transforming the ag food ecosystem through policy advisory, market entry, and ecosystem solutions. And Then Ace Foods, which is an agro-processing company that works with about 10,000 farmers and processes for the local market. My vantage point here, three points. The first one is that we need to change the face of Africa from a hungry child to a successful female entrepreneur. We believe that Africa has a lot of solutions to the global food ecosystem, and that working with local organizations, especially small and medium-sized enterprises, we can really transform the food ecosystem, enabling our small and medium-sized enterprises to understand how to be sustainable, equitable, and to provide nutritious food. The second is the importance of and the prioritization of investing in local organizations. I think the food ecosystem has remained largely broken because of our focus of interventions on intermediaries. On one hand, large businesses on the other, and then smallholder farmers, without really thinking about the critical role of small and medium-sized enterprises, providing nutritious food, driving innovation and change, and empowering those ecosystem players to really thrive, but also shifting the resources, the power, and the engagement to local organizations. And then the final one is really the importance of innovation around nutritious food, a clear understanding of what healthy diets are, promotion of knowledge and interventions, not only in public procurement programs, school feeding, but also from farm to fork at homes. And I think we're seeing a lot of innovation in that area, and I look forward to engaging with all of you as we walk through this panel. Thanks so much.
Cool. Thank you very much, Ndidi. So just to get into the discussion proper a bit, Edwin, if I can start with you, because you're kind of at the cutting edge here. You're producing a meat substitute product, and you're trying
new meat,
you're trying to market it directly to carnivores, to people who love meat, and I guess are a little bit suspicious. How do you go about convincing those people that this is a sustainable alternative that they should try?
As always, it starts with taste. So if the experience isn't good enough, especially carnivores will abandon. Vegans, vegetarians, and some flexitarians, they are ready to compromise. Meat lovers will say, guys, please, I understand everything, but don't touch my meat. So the only way to get them in is really to deliver the product that does give the right mouthfeel, the taste, no aftertaste, the same cooking experience and all the like. So kind of mimicking the animal version is critical. The other element that we've also learned from various consumer research is that the carnivores have a kind of an allergy to anything that is green, vegan, etc. So what we're trying to do is in all our brand assets, basically to play with the codes of meat. So you'll see our packaging, it's black, it's red. The imagery does look very similar to cooking with meat. And that's exactly what they like. So they don't want to be in the kitchen and find themselves with a product that they need to treat differently, that smells different, that looks different. So getting as close as possible to the animal version is critical, and in applying that in your communication as well.
Yeah. Can you tell us more? What is the product? So we get. I mean, there's a lot of
diversity. So we have actually. There's two things that we try to address. One is quality, and the other is versatility. So we do have this portfolio of whole cuts, so a flank steak and tenderloin and a strip loin, and we have also, let's say, mince-based products like burger, minced bratwurst, and merguez, a lamb kebab or kofta mix, allowing you basically to pulled pork, pulled beef, to integrate those products in as many weekly dishes as possible. What we've seen is that today consumers lack actually the quality of the product to apply it in multiple dishes because of the aftertaste, because of the texture, because of the smell, whatever. So by elevating the quality level, we believe we can actually integrate in more consumption occasions, driving the repeat purchase. So when you look at the plant-based meat category today, it's basically following the S-curve. So the level of adoption is stagnating. That's directly connected to the quality and the level of innovation. And by elevating the quality and the versatility, we try to bring back this growth, push penetration, and increase the repeat purchase.
That's interesting. You touched on colors a bit, you know, using red and the kind of colors that carnivores are used to. And I remember that, Jenny, you talked a lot about behavioral science and the way that you kind of use behavioral science to try and change the way people look at what they're eating. Colors, is that, I'm guessing that's something that comes in?
I think it's kind of slightly different approach, because kind of if you look at the Cool Food Program, what we're trying to do is shift people's, you know, in order to meet our goals, we need to shift meat eaters to be eating less ruminant meat. So yes, this is a meat alternative, but it's also the area of dairy that we need to be looking at as well. So I think with those behavioural nudges, they kind of, that we look at, so we have a playbook that is on the WRO website, and it categorises all those behavioural nudges into like the product. Mm-hmm. So in the product, it's like, what can you do? How can you reformulate that product? But there are other things like the presentation of it. So we don't look so much at the kind of packaging. We look more like the kind of behavioural change techniques. So if you look at the presentation when you go into... For example, when you go into a corporate dining facility, you might put your vegetarian lasagna ahead of the meat lasagna. You might have a special, on a Friday, you might make that a plant-based option. So it's trying to really highlight the more plant-based options. You might then do an incentive, a meal deal of like a, you know, a vegetarian, a plant-based option.
Okay.
So, yes, I think this is one solution, but what we're trying to do is do a number of different ways to actually nudge consumers to a more sustainable diet.
And can I add to that?
Mm.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, because there's a very critical element, that is price. And there's multiple ways to address that. One of them is actually through pricing. I happen to be a board member of the True Animal Protein Price Coalition. It's a long word for promoting true pricing for animal dairy and animal meat. Today, there's a lot of subsidies that go into the industry. There's no costing for the environmental damage, health damage, etc. So we're trying to make governments aware of the impact and actually the necessity to drive change by creating a level playing field for both entrepreneurs in the plant-based sector and the animal sector. It's very unfair to think that a farmer or the meat industry gets, just for the Netherlands, about 800 million euro of subsidies, whereas the plant-based industry maybe gets 15 or so. Mm. And there's differences in VAT. So there's plenty of things that we need to address. Ultimately, the consumer will decide based off price. So if you want to drive change, price is critical. Taxation, one thing. The other is driving scale. So we need to collaborate in the whole value chain to bring down the cost. And that requires innovation in every piece of the value chain. It's not just being extremely efficient in processing the foods. It's also about developing new source of protein, new binders, new colorants, whatever, all plant-based. And the industry needs to collaborate to come up with those solutions and to make them price competitive. Mm.
So, I mean, we've talked a bit about price. We've talked about consumer behavior and how things are presented to people. Paloma, I know you were very interested in design, the way that foods are designed and presented to a consumer. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I guess our approach is complementary as well to, you know, what you can do with meat alternatives, but also with, you know, shifting kind of what's on your plate as well. At FutureFit Foods, we focus very much on designing foods that are really good for people and planet. And just one example, our leaping legumes products are essentially black and golden chickpeas. So we've picked an ingredient that is critical in fixating nitrogen into the soil, that is a critical, legumes are actually really good in rotational agriculture. It really helps with soil health, but it also is an ingredient that actually people love as a snack. A lot of people like snacks, so it's a very familiar food. It's simple. And then we've also really thought through where are these ingredients coming from. So we actually source, we're based in Colorado, we source our chickpeas from the Rocky Mountain region from a group of farmers that are actually the same community that is behind the book, The Lentil Underground. Very forward-thinking farmers that are really at the forefront that really need a marketplace. So sourcing is going to be very important. These are organic farmers that are starting to apply a number of regenerative organic practices as well. And then finally, I think what's really, really important is that you think through not only how you design the food and what's in the food, but also, you know, what does this do for people's health, right, at the end of the day? It's clearly going to be tasty because it's a snack, but how do we get to a healthy snack? That's where the lack of options is in the market. So we have what we have done at Future Fit Foods is that we have essentially worked with a technology that was invented by the Incas. It's called freeze drying, that then NASA improved. And what freeze drying does is it removes the water in the food. You essentially freeze the food, and then you extract the water in a steam form. So you protect 95% of the nutrients, the texture, the color, the flavor. So the organoleptic experience of the food is great. But also, it means that we don't need to use oils, we don't need to use sugars, and we only have 3% sodium. So technology can be a huge enabler to healthier food. And, you know, at Future Fit Foods, we're really kind of playing on the camp of what exists already in, you know, the 30,000 plus ingredients that are out there that, and of the few that people absolutely love, that we can amplify and we can take to the next level as a natural, healthy snack. So, and we have a lot of learning through Future Fit Foods because we've experimented with much more complicated products before. And one of the biggest learnings is simplicity can go a long ways. And there's a lot of ingredients that exist today, a lot of foods that have a lot of legs in this space of plant-based within the natural kind of remit. So, I think it's complementary to, you know, what can we do with existing diets, right? Shifting the plate. What's complementary to, you know, meat analogs. But we also can't forget the diversity of foods that exist in this world and how much potential they have once you give them a little bit of kind of a front stage.
On that point about the diversity of foods and different diets, I think I should bring Ndidi back in to talk about the African experience. How much of what we've been saying, Ndidi, if you can hear me, how much of what we've been saying speaks to the kind of to the markets that you've been working with in Africa?
Thank you so much. Yes, I would say that there are a few things that resonate with me. Obviously, nutritious food has to be affordable, available, acceptable, and accessible. And through our work, we've seen this tension between taste, which is acceptability, and we've seen a lot of mistakes. You know, orange flesh sweet potato was one trend that a lot of people adopted, right? We have seen the interventions with vitamin A maize and vitamin A cassava, and in many communities, even though it's nutritious, if it's not tasty, it's not the right color, the lowest income populations who you're trying to target will not accept it and will not purchase it. That's one tension. The second is really the issue around snacks or food products that are convenient and available. And we see, you know, a lot of effort on reviving indigenous crops, scaling forgotten crops, beans, our lentils, millets, our sorghums. We've seen some movement around products such as Fonio through companies all over the world. We've seen a lot of movement in those areas, but what we were challenged ourselves to is, what does it take to make it convenient? It takes about 3 hours for a woman to cook soya beans on a pot in a stove where she's spending, you know, kerosene or gas, and that's not convenient. So at Ace Foods, one of the things we tried to do is introduce a snack product that was available, accessible, and acceptable. And it took us 5 years. And this is the role where we see innovation. You see the burden of the price point. And in our case, our price point was 50 naira, which is less than 10 cents, because you want it affordable. And so in many parts of the world, we're designing for the elite. We're designing for those who can afford our expensive healthy food interventions, and we're forgetting that there is a price point barrier for the most vulnerable and the lowest income populations. There's a convenience barrier, and there's an acceptability and accessibility barrier. And we've embraced this wholeheartedly, but it took us 5 years, right? So I think we need a lot more collaboration in the science, innovation, marketing and branding communities to do this together. I also think we need to be very conscious of the need to move the pipeline from just niche products, which we often describe and celebrate, to mainstream mass products, because that's where you're really going to see the change. There has been a lot of intervention around fortification, micronutrient powders, etc. But we see that many large companies and even small companies are not complying. And then how they're packaging this food when it's exposed to sunlight, it loses a lot of its potency. So that's another key issue. And then finally, I would like to say that we've forgotten a lot of some of the best crops in our continents that the rest of the world can value. So we're starting to change mindsets and tell stories through African food change makers about the TEFs, about the rooibos, about a lot of the food that Africa has contributed to the world that is healthy, that is nutritious, and that can be supported at scale. And I would love to partner with many more of you to tell those positive stories to drive demand, innovation, and research for some of our almost forgotten crops that are not celebrated and not recognized. And that will really help also to drive the collaboration and build the bridges that we need across the food ecosystem.
I see a lot of people nodding away to those two key points about forgotten ingredients, things that we used to eat and that are still potentially healthy and sustainable, but just kind of went out of fashion. And the other point about telling stories about our ingredients, about our products, about our processes that engages people and draws them in and makes them want to take part. But one thing that's missing is innovation and technology. Dr. De Klerk, can I ask you, how can we use innovation and technology to change people's minds about their diet?
Yeah, I want to take a step back, because I think there's some critical questions around innovation technology and how they fit within the system, right? So one, I think we need to realize how mission critical this is. Right, half of the world's population is struggling to access healthy diets, just healthy diets. I'm not talking about sustainable. Right? So this is a major challenge, right? The major drivers of premature mortality are our food. Right? So our most proximate relationship with health is failing on health. Second, you know, food is 30% of climate, and we're talking a lot about climate today, but it's 80% of freshwater use, it's 80% of biodiversity loss, 80% of nitrogen phosphorus pollution. So this has to be a systemic solution. Three, the problem is Western diets, right? So our diets in this community is the problem. It's not Nadili's diet. It's not the traditional Asian diet, but it's our diet, which has 500 to 800% overconsumption of red meat. And this is why we talk so much about meat. But the flip side of the meat equation is diversity, which was your question to Nadili, right? So we're under-consuming fruits, nuts, vegetables, plant-based proteins, right? So we anticipate 175% increased consumption of nuts, for example, as a key part of the challenge. And so while we talk a lot about reducing meat consumption, this needs to be matched with the whole diet approach that says, well, how do we increase the consumption of these protective foods? Because the major driver of poor health is not so much overconsumption of meat, but if you have 2,500 calories per day, and the majority of that comes from meat, that means you're under-consuming the protective foods, fruits, nuts, and legumes. So we need to talk about how do we reduce meat consumption, but how do we replace that with consumption of those foods that are protective. So this is where I think part of your solution is really important. So when we look at this, diversity really is the option. And what's interesting is that low diversity is the same challenge for those who are struggling with hunger and malnutrition. It's also the challenge that those of us who are struggling with obesity and overweight are faced with low dietary diversity. We're eating too much of the same shit. Same thing in agriculture. Our agriculture is too low in diversity. So Paloma's solution is interesting because it takes a plant which is able to take the 80% nitrogen out of the atmosphere, put it back in the soils, and nitrogen is the building block of protein. And so it's this eloquent solution that is agroecological, it improves soil quality, reduces climate impact, and provides you with a food. And this is a traditional solution, right? The Mayan Three Sisters system was growing rice, beans, and squash in the same field. And when you look at that, it's growing a C4 plant adapted to tropical environments. It's a nitrogen-fixing legume, and it's a squash which grows, occupies the last light left in the ground. And from a nutrition point of view, it's carbohydrates, vitamin A, and protein. So really eloquent solution to the two. So a lot of inspiration can come from traditional systems. I think the challenge for innovation is how do you bring the innovation that amplifies that, right? Mm-hmm. So quite often we're looking at single system solutions, and I think there's a dearth of solutions that are really asking about how do we contribute to these systemic changes that we need. And that's a real challenge for those who work in tech, where often you're looking for something you can scale rapidly and maybe not enough space to how do we think about this from a very systemic point of view. And I'll conclude with one last thing. And Dili, I hope you look at the New York Times today. There's a great article on Theo Moulin, Senegalese dish, which is exactly what we're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. So quite often, you know, we're looking for these solutions, but I think we need to remind ourselves this isn't rocket science.
Remind me, sorry, the Senegalese dish?
What's that?
The name of the Senegalese dish?
I'm probably going to thrash it. Theo Moulin, I thought it was. Okay. It's rice, fish, tomato rice, sauce, chibugen, okra. Yeah.
Chibugen, they call it, yeah.
It was a different name.
It starts with a T-C-H, yeah.
The queen of Senegal's food was the headline. So yeah. Ndili, I think, you know, your point is that, you know, where are these foods? Why aren't we celebrating them? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the advantages of globalization is that, you know, we're looking for dietary diversity, which can be from our own culture, but it's an opportunity to celebrate other cultures, right? You know, so when we look at the meat challenge, Asian food bowls, that's a great way to have a smaller meat proportion. And if you want to go even further, to have a plant-based meat proportion within a bowl. You know, the African option is also there, which often emphasizes much more bean consumption. Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous invitation to explore diversity, embrace diversity. And I think what's unique about food, compared to, you know, having to buy a Tesla or put solar panels on my house, is that everyday decisions that I make have impact. I can speak to all of you about food. I can speak to Bill Clinton about food. I can speak to my mother about food. My daughter was talking to her classmates about food this Sunday. So it's a really accessible topic that empowers us to make change with solutions that are affordable, accessible, and available, but that are going to demand, I think, some of this focus on behavior change.
Yeah, 100%. Some really interesting stuff so far. I'm conscious of time. We have 10 minutes left. So we've got a couple of people with microphones who are walking around. And if you can stick your hand up if you have a question for the panel, it'd be great to hear some of your perspectives, having taken part in the discussion. In the meantime, we were talking a little bit about, one point I thought you made that was really, really interesting, you know, unlike with energy and, say, buying a Tesla and sticking a whole load of solar panels, we get three opportunities a day and more to do something about food. And another thing that you touched on was this notion that there are a whole bunch of different types of food, different recipes, different ways of preparing the same foods that we've always eaten. Do you think there's a room, a space whereby we can simply introduce consumers to other types of cuisine and achieve the same?
I think it comes down to kind of the training. I think it's consumers being familiar with some of these products, some of these ingredients, knowing what to do with them. Yeah. I think it's that bigger education piece, and it's educating also kind of chefs, people working within the food industry as well, to actually put those plant-based dishes on the menu.
Yeah.
So that instead of being sort of, you know, previously you would see the vegetarian options at the bottom, now you're beginning to see them throughout the menu.
Yeah.
And I think it's making everything much more mainstream. So the chefs can then are making these plant-based dishes, which then driving consumers to say, oh, I really enjoyed that dish. But it's also getting back to some of those traditional dishes as well.
I was thinking, when you mentioned poke bowls, the rice bowls, I had my first one in Paris this summer, like, yeah. Super fashionable for the last 3-4 years. And I kind of, as a carnivore, I guess it was too green for me. Okay, I just ignored, and I had my first one. And I was amazed at how much I've been missing out. It is a bowl of rice and vegetables with a tiny bit of fish. I didn't miss the fish at all, or the meat at all. But what I noticed is that all down the high street, these places have become so fashionable that the high street has become more green. Literally, as you're walking past, every window has a big bowl of green vegetables in it. Do you think that's having an effect on me? Is that part of the reason why I've ended up trying one after 5 years of shunning them?
No, I think it's having a huge effect, right? I mean, we want to talk about behavior change. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, for my birthday, you know, I'd ask mom for sushi. And it was, I was grew up in Los Angeles. There was one place you could get it, right? And it was this really exotic thing. I mean, it's now sold in Carrefour, right? Yeah. So I think these changes are massive there. And I remember being in China, and someone said to me, Dr. De Klerk, I mean, you don't want to allow us to eat our hamburger. You know, what right do you have to, you know, to dictate, you know, what we see as ambition? I said, I'm really confused here. I mean, is your ambition to have the same health crisis that we see in Mexico, whereas in California, we're all looking to Asian foods? And so there's this really interesting interplay between how do we define ambition? And I think food, again, has an opportunity to say, look, it's about cultural sharing. It's about diversity. It's about taste. Greg Drescher from Come to America is going to remind me, taste. You mentioned it, taste as well. But there's no limit to taste, right? I mean, your garbanzos, you're using garam masala, right? Indian flavors, Indian spices to explore. It's a great way to travel without having to take a plane. And so I think there's TikTok. I mean, TikTok and Instagram, it's all food porn, right? I mean, this is... So I mean, food is, I think, a major gateway toward sustainability, and it's not about wearing, you know, an oil cloth and flogging yourself. It's about exploration of diversity, taste, and culture. Okay. Right? I can travel to Senegal.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. Thank you so much for listening.